From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! 6,000 more GM workers join the strike in Michigan. We'll talk to a striker on the front lines. Also, today marks the 100th anniversary of the Philippine Declaration of Independence. We'll be talking about the recent elections and a century of U.S. colonization and how it affects women in the Philippines. Finally, we'll speak with Gaza human rights activist Raji Sarani. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The United Auto Workers in Flint, Michigan, stepped up its campaign against General Motors last night by striking the sprawling Delphi Flint East Complex, which supplies parts for nearly every GM vehicle made in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. About 6,000 workers joined the strike. The walkout came 6 days after workers went on strike across town at the Flint Metal Center, a stamping plant. 25,000 workers at 24 other plants have since been laid off by GM. Effects of the strike have spread to 9 states, Mexico and Canada. Most of GM's other North American assembly plants could be idled by the end of next week. We'll have more on this story later in the show. After weeks of pummeling of his outreach to China, President Clinton issued a broad defense yesterday of his decision to seek closer relations with Beijing, arguing that expanding cooperation is critical to preserving U.S. national security and building a stable internal order. The half-hour address at the National Geographic Society came on the same day that a Senate panel opened hearings featuring allegations that U.S. policy had led to sensitive technology passing to the Chinese from private U.S. firms. When he arrives on his 9-day, 5-city journey on June 25th, Clinton will be the first U.S. president to visit China since the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989. In which Chinese troops killed hundreds of pro-democracy demonstrators, and in the most politically charged moment on his schedule, he will participate in a welcoming ceremony in Tiananmen Square. This news from Dili, East Timor, a dozen political prisoners released by Indonesia's president raised their fists on their way out of jail in East Timor today and vowed to renew their struggle for self-determination. More than 1,000 East Timorese protesters also gathered at the foreign ministry in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta to demand a vote on independence. Police and troops eventually broke up the rally by beating and kicking protesters, confiscating Timorese flags and anti-Indonesian banners, and herding people onto buses that were driven away under police escort. And the chief of the Indonesian military said today he's authorized security forces to, quote, clean up activities that threaten national stability and urged government critics to give the country's new president, B.J. Habibie, a chance to implement political reforms. General Wiranto, who is also defense minister, told reporters that unconstitutional activities had become destabilizing. He specifically talked about recent demonstrations in smaller cities aimed at forcing the resignation of local officials. On the island of Bali, for example, more than 20,000 people protested. Meanwhile, an Indonesian political activist was reported missing last month, found dead 2 days later with a stab wound through his heart. This according to the Commission for Missing Persons and Victims of Violence. According to a lawyer with the Legal Aid Foundation, since the end of March, the activist, Leonardus Nugroho, had been a coordinator for maintaining order amongst the students during demonstrations at the university in Solo. This news from Washington, and a victory for gay rights with implications for the millions of people who use computer online services. Both the Navy and America Online have reached settlements with a highly decorated sailor who was investigated by the Navy after he posted a message in which he described himself as gay. Under the Navy agreement, Master Chief Petty Officer Timothy McVeigh, no relation, will retire from the military with full benefits and with tens of thousands of dollars to pay his legal fees. The Navy had originally sought to discharge McVeigh without any benefits after he posted a note on the online service in which he identified himself as Tim, whose marital status was gay. The five activists who hammered on a B-52 bomber at Andrews Air Force Base this May were arraigned in federal court in Greenbelt, Maryland this week. The five, who call themselves the Gods of Metal Plowshares, were charged with one misdemeanor count of damage to government property. They face up to 1 year in prison and $100,000 in fines. This is a lesser charge than the two felonies they were originally facing. The five go to trial on September 21st in Maryland. According to the newsletter of the U.S. campaign to free Mordechai Vanunu, Jimmy Carter this spring joined political leaders from around the world in calling for the immediate release of prisoner of conscience Mordechai Vanunu. Word was received in mid-April from Carter's aides in Atlanta, Georgia, that the ex-president had sent a message to Israeli President Ezer Weitzman asking him to use his executive powers of clemency to free Mordechai Vanunu. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Nearly 6,000 workers went on strike this evening at a General Motors factory in Flint, Michigan, joining fellow strikers at a nearby GM plant in an increasingly bitter fight that could close virtually all of the company's North American assembly plants within days. General Motors, the world's largest automaker, had already closed 7 of those assembly plants and temporarily laid off 18,600 workers for lack of parts from the initial strike last Friday at a metal stamping plant in Flint. Most of GM's 22 other assembly plants in the United States, Canada, and Mexico are expected to quickly run out of the spark plugs, speedometers, and other parts made by the giant factory where workers walked out last evening. We're joined now by Norm McComb, who's vice president of the United Auto Workers Local 659 in Flint, Michigan. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, tell us what's happening there in Flint.
Well, right now we have two facilities in Flint, Michigan. They're currently on strike. Negotiations are underway at both facilities. The Flint Metal Center, the unit that's associated with this local union, 659, has been on strike since last Friday, and negotiations at that plant hasn't produced one settlement of a single issue. So it looks like we're dug in for a long-term strike.
How did this come about?
It came about because General Motors made a written agreement with the local union back in 1995 at the Flint Metal Center to invest in that plant and bring in some new presses so that they could be competitive and retain work that they already currently were doing, and promised them new work at that plant to secure jobs for the future of that location in this community. In return, the local union agreed that they would change the work rules in association with the new equipment coming in. In other words, they would not have PEG standards or production quotas. They would run the equipment whistle to whistle. That was the agreement. General Motors then, since then, has reneged on bringing in the equipment. They've stopped their investment in the plant. They came in there on May 24th. It was Labor Day weekend, in the middle of the night, hired a scab union trucking company, stole the dies out of there that had been sent there as part of this new work commitment, and sent them to another facility. And, of course, that infuriated the union, infuriated the membership, and definitely showed that management was not keeping their word and their commitment to this union and to its membership.
Norm McComb of local UAW in Flint, Michigan, can you tell us about the walkout last night?
Well, at 7 p.m. last night, the local union 651, which is AC Delphi East, didn't resolve their problems over there between the corporation and their union representatives, and their five-day letter expired at 7 p.m. They called a strike, and they walked out of the plant, and it's now shut down.
In addition to Norm McComb joining us from Flint, Michigan, Vice President of UAW Local 659, we're joined by Kim Moody, who is the Director of Labor Notes, which is a labor magazine based in Detroit, Michigan. He's also author of Workers in a Lean World. Kim Moody, can you set this strike in a larger context of the union movement in the United States? Sorry, we're having a little trouble hearing you. We'll try to do that in a minute. But let me just put the question to Norm McComb of the UAW local in Flint, Michigan. How this fits in, do you see, to union activism in the United States?
This hasn't got anything about union activism. This is about a union and a company that sat down and negotiated an agreement, signed it in writing, and in good faith, both sides said, this is what we'll do. And General Motors, the company, the corporation, has reneged on that commitment to this local union. That's what this is about. And it's about the jobs and the security and the future of the jobs in this country, and particularly in this situation in our community.
I think we have Kim Moody on the line with us now from Labor Notes in Detroit. Kim Moody, the question that I asked earlier, if you can fit this into a larger context.
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Well, of course, Norm is right about the issues, but I think the thing is that General Motors and most of these big corporations are doing this all the time. They're downsizing, they're outsourcing, they're part-timing, they're casualizing work. So I think the significance of this strike, you know, it is actually bigger in that in this strike and the UPS strike last year, the Dayton GM strike a couple of years ago, these strikes have gotten enormous support from the public when they do polls on these things, whereas 10 years ago, most of the public probably would have sided with management. And I think the reason is that people out there, not just union members, but working people generally, see their own issues in these strikes. They see companies double-crossing them, sending work elsewhere, downsizing, and generally creating, you know, a social problem in this country. So I think a lot of people look at Local 659 and 651 and they say, you know, right on, good. You know, somebody's got to wage this fight.
Now, this is, what, the ninth strike in how many years of GM workers?
Well, it's the ninth strike since the Dayton strike 2 years ago. Actually, there have been more strikes. They go all the way back to 1994 in General Motors alone.
How do you see the international union, how do you see that fitting into this local strike in terms of its support and how it compares to earlier support?
Well, I think the problem is that a lot of people from the other locals, I don't know what the brothers and sisters from the current strike would say, but from other locals, felt that the international was letting the local unions wage this fight one at a time, instead of having any coordinated policy. On this particular strike, these dies that were removed from the Flint Metal Center were sent to Mansfield, Ohio, where they will be making parts for this new truck line, although actually they won't be able to produce them because the Oshawa, Ontario plant is where it was going to be produced is closed due to the strike, but they would be stamping these parts down there. Now, the UAW International could have had the Mansfield local do a five-day strike letter as well at the same time and prevent this kind of thing where one plant is working against another. So I think a lot of people feel there was a lack of overall strategy, and I know there will be a resolution coming from some of the locals that struck last year at the convention, which is just in a little over a week, at the UAW's Constitutional Convention, calling on the union to do what it used to do, which is to not settle the national contract until local issues are settled, which would not necessarily solve everyone's problems. It wouldn't solve the problem at Flint, but it would create more of a strategic sort of solidarity-type approach that used to exist under, say, Ruther.
Norm McComb, Vice President of UAW Local 659, would you agree with Kim Moody's assessment of the international vis-a-vis the local?
I agree with him 100%, and that's a problem in this country, and it isn't just in General Motors either. It's, like he said, the corporations all over this country are taking advantage of NAFTA, and that is the bottom line. They're taking work out of this country where they're paying a better wage and are paying a benefit to their members and are under stricter rules for health and safety and environmental rules, and they're going to places like Mexico, third world countries, and setting up where there are no laws, there are no rules governing environmental, health and safety issues are non-existent, health care benefits is non-existent, low wages, 50 cents, a dollar, dollar and a quarter an hour is the norm, and they're taking the work out of this country, relocating it in, back in those countries, and then returning the product back to this country for sale for huge profits. And at the expense of the working people of this country. And it's happening very fast. It's happening all over the country. You can read the paper almost every day where some company is picking up and moving to Mexico to take advantage of those situations that they can avoid here in this country in the name of profit for themselves.
I understand that the vice president of General Motors has made a number of comments about how GM has learned how to deal with this strike from UPS, and he's also made comments as well about globalization. Can you elaborate on that?
You talking about Jokic?
Yes.
Well, you know, General Motors came to the union in the middle 80s. They were losing market share. They were financially strapped. And they came to the union and said, look, we need concessions. We need to recognize that the people that are our employees are our greatest asset. And over the years, we've ignored that. And we need to change the way we do business. We need to work together as a team to win. We need to gain back market share, which will do two things. It will grow the profitability of the company and secure the work in the future of the membership of these plants. That made sense, and the union did that. We made concessions. We embarked upon innovative agreements that created teams, cooperation. They involved the people, had more input in their jobs because there isn't anyone in the world who knows how to do things better than the people that are doing it, the workers. The quality of their vehicles went up, their sales went up, their profits went up in huge numbers. They made more last year in the history of the company. They're setting on $13 billion reserve. They've rewarded their top executives millions of dollars, like $22 million. Last year, their top executives was given as bonuses. And while they continue to threaten the workers in this country, saying that they're unproductive and the quality isn't good, and using it as an excuse just to move their operations where they can get it even done cheaper and make more money.
How long do you see this strike going on, and how many people do you see it involving?
Well, first of all, if we knew how long it was going to go on, we wouldn't have had to strike the first place. But who knows? That is strictly up to General Motors. Our bargaining team on the union side of the house stands ready at any time to sit down and sincerely and honestly resolve these issues. We can't get GM to come to the table in that same mode. When they decide that, okay, they made a mistake, they lied to us, they're going to correct that, they'll keep their commitment, then we can get on, resolve these issues, and get back to building quality cars and get our people back to work, and they can have their jobs, and General Motors can get back into the profit business. That's up to them.
Norm McComb and Kim Moody, I've just been joined by Juan Gonzalez, who's getting used to our new site on Wall Street. I cringe a little to tell you we're on Wall Street right now, but we've just moved here, and Juan's just made it into the studio. But Juan, you have been interested in the issue of lean production.
Yes, and especially since Kim has written about it in his tremendous recent book. How has this whole automobile strategy of lean production and just-in-time production affected the company throughout, and actually, it seems to me, come to the benefit of the union in terms of this strike?
And explain this idea of just-in-time, which one wasn't this one?
Yeah, this is a new system where plants are more closely linked. That is, parts from, say, this Delphi plant or from the stamping plant that's on strike now would not be stockpiled in an assembly plant. They would arrive, you know, they would have maybe only a couple of hours or a half a day stock in the plant, whereas in the old days they would have a couple of weeks or even a month worth. That's what just-in-time means. So obviously that means when the parts plant or the stamping plant goes on strike, the assembly plant's going to close down much faster than it would have in the old days. And so this gives the union a lot of leverage. We can see now that, well, as of yesterday, I don't know what the count is today, but as of yesterday, at least 8 assembly plants were down, and lots of parts plants, and even non-GM plants that supply those GM plants are going down. So this has a big impact that gives the union, you know, a certain amount of leverage that perhaps they didn't have 15 or 20 years ago.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Kim Moody, Director of Labor Notes, based in Detroit, Michigan, also author of the book Workers in a Lean World. And Kim, if people want to get a hold of Labor Notes, where can they call?
Well, they can give us a call at 313-842-6262. That's our headquarters in Detroit.
And Norma Combe, thank you very much for joining us, Vice President of the UAW Local 659 in Flint, Michigan. How are you directing people to support your strike around the country?
So far, all we're asking is that the other unions, the members of the UAW locals that aren't currently on strike, support us, the people in the community. Already in this area have shown tremendous support. They've brought pop and donuts and even sandwiches to the picket lines. They've stopped and talked to the picketers. They've even walked with them. And if they can't do that, as they go by, they blow their horns to show their support. It's just been tremendous, and that's all we can ask.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Norma Combe and Kim Moody. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be speaking with one of the leading Palestinian human rights activists. He's just in this country for a little while. And then we're going to look at the 100th anniversary of, well, both U.S. occupation of the Philippines and also Philippine independence. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Juan Gonzalez. Juan, actually, you are just in time, so thanks for joining us.
Yes.
But we got an interesting email yesterday from an AIDS activist who talked about a piece in the New York Times, Logjam on Bill to Cut Smoking Starts to Unclog. And it says that there was an amendment included in that passed 52-46 that would, among other things, permanently ban federal funds for needle exchanges. This is close to, writes the our person who sent us email, or identical to a bill passed last month by the House, so it's certain to now be included in the final bill sent to Clinton. Though not mentioned by the Times, the ban includes the words directly or indirectly, meaning it will not only prohibit any future president from funding needle distribution, but also from any funds going to programs that perform this. Currently, many larger aid service organizations that also run needle exchanges get federal funds, which would be jeopardized. And a few needle exchanges already get federal funds for non-needle activities, such as drug treatment referrals, counseling, and acupuncture. All of this would be at risk of being cut off if Clinton signs the bill with the amendment. We're going to deal with this next week, but it is extremely significant, of course, one of the many aspects of larger bills that we often don't hear about until after it's passed, and this would have tremendous implications. Well, that's one issue, but we're going to turn to a very different issue right now. We're going to go to the Middle East and talk about what's happening on the West Bank and Gaza and in Israel. The PLO Executive Committee, led by Palestinian President Yasser Arafat, decided yesterday to reshuffle the cabinet, and a new government could be in place within 2 weeks. Also, CIA Director George Tenet met President Yasser Arafat secretly in the Palestinian-ruled Gaza Strip on Wednesday night. This according to Israel Radio and a Palestinian security official. It was the second surprise meeting this week involving Washington, the key Middle East peace broker. U.S. Ambassador to Israel Edward Walker held talks on Sunday between Israeli and Palestinian peace negotiators. The Palestinian security official, who didn't want to be identified, told Israel Radio of the Tenet-Arafat meeting, but gave no details, only to say the meeting took place. Well, we're joined right now by Raji Sarani. I met Raji Sarani a few years ago in Washington, D.C., when he won the RFK Human Rights Award. He's one of the Gaza Strip's foremost human rights lawyers, director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, an organization that monitors the human rights practices of the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well,
it's
great
to be here.
It's good to have you. What about this latest news first of the Palestinian Authority reshuffling, or Yasser Arafat reshuffling the cabinet? How significant is this?
Well, actually, last June 1997, PA issued auditing report concerning the financial situation, monopolies, and corruption in the PA areas. And this was taken afterwards by the Palestinian Legislative Council, and the Legislative Council decided in August to reshuffle, actually, the government. And though this is extremely late, I mean, it's almost 10 months later, but it's quite important, and hopefully it push in positive direction to activate entirely the Palestinian Legislative Council and its role.
Mm-hmm. And what about George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence in this country, going to meet with Yasser Arafat? What are the CIA's interests here?
Well, I think around the clock, I mean, all the way along, there is cooperation between CIA, the Palestinian secret security, and the Israeli security. And this is one of the real issues going on all the way along against the claims, I mean, of the Israelis, by the way. And in the same time, while cooperation, these aspects, security aspects, there are no cooperation on the political level, actually.
And how is this cooperation affecting the human rights situation within the Palestinian territories?
Very unfortunately, since the very beginning of the peace process in the Middle East, especially with the PA, Palestinian Authority, what has been victimized, human rights, rule of law, and democracy on the expense of security and peace. And that's, I mean, one of the most shocking issues. To that extent, we came to the stage right now where it's the worst in the last 30 years.
And specifically, how is it worst? Can you give us some examples? Or?
Well, on both agendas, the Israeli agenda and the Palestinian agenda, I mean, torture in the Israeli legal system legalized, and it has been not only given legal cover, but also judiciary cover as well. And that's very unique and very special, and especially if we are realize and know this torture, you know, being conducted in systematic way against all Palestinians. And hundreds of Palestinians still in administrative detention as well. besides almost 4,000 Palestinian prisoners still held after the peace accord was signed in 1993, September. From the other side, I mean, there is lack of respect for the court decisions in the Palestinian Authority area of jurisdiction, and there is also a lack of respect for the Palestinian Legislative Council decisions. There is the State Security Courts, which has been the PA pressured, you know, to form it, and as well they restricted the freedom of expression. All these phenomena, from security point of view, brought the situation to devastating situation, really.
We're talking to Raji Sarani, a leading Palestinian human rights activist. He runs on the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. You have been, well, extremely critical, obviously, of the Israeli occupation, but also of the Palestinian Authority. Can you explain your chief problems, your run-ins with the Palestinian Authority?
We have eight areas of our concern related to freedom of expression and assembly, related to the formation of the State Security Courts, massive waves of arrests for the opposition without any due legal procedures, the militarization of the Palestinian civil society, the lack of respect for the court decisions. Also, we have a problem with the lack of respect for legislative council decision. And there is, as well, monopolies and corruption by some PA officials, and that was in secret. Also, we are facing problem related to the misadministration, and some torture has been conducted by the PA. The unique and special things in these eight areas of our concern, very unfortunately, that five of them, PA do it according to Israeli-American pressure on it. And that, you know, quite astonishing, I mean, for us as a human rights movement, because we thought in the era of peace, Israel and the U.S. administration should encourage rule of law, democracy, and the human rights. But their pressure on the Palestinian Authority gives to incredible results, I mean, on this aspect. Just one thing more I want to add, really, that I don't mean with that an excuse for the PA, because Palestinian Authority should be committed to the interest of the Palestinian people, and it should resist, I mean, all the pressure by the American administration or by Israel. In the end of the day, democracy, rule of law, and the human rights will lie down the Palestinian issue to achieve its goal of self-determination and independence.
What about the continuing debate or lack of agreement over the territories within Jerusalem itself? How is that affecting the human rights situation of the Palestinians in Jerusalem?
Well, within 30 years, you know that Israel not only annexed East Jerusalem de facto and de jure by Knesset decision, but also, I mean, the American Congress, I mean, as well decided Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, while Palestinians have no intention ever, never to decide what's the capital of the United States. And that's, I mean, extremely critical. Now, in very sophisticated, complicated legal and the procedural mechanisms, Israel de facto making ethnic cleansing actually in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem, precisely for the Palestinians, Christians or Muslims, and the number there, it drastically dropped, and they expanded East Jerusalem to be 40% almost of the West Bank. That's what they call it, Greater Jerusalem, and it's almost the issue of Jerusalem ruled out for any future negotiation. And if this policy continuing all the way along by adding more settlements in Jerusalem, by buying land and confiscation of land, by Har Humma, and by, you know, attacking the holy sites for Christians and Muslims, this will lead to a situation after 10, 15 years there would be no Palestinians.
Shimon Peres is in Bonn right now, and he just finished a news conference. He says the peace process isn't dead, even though it's fallen into poor health, and warns the window of opportunity will not stay open indefinitely. And he also said he welcomes the European Union efforts to join the U.S. in achieving peace. What are your comments on Israel's view of the peace process and what you think has to happen right now?
Well, Mr. Netanyahu, in a clear cut way, a couple of weeks ago, said that the peace process is dead. But we are saying that, I mean, for the last 2.5 years, actually, that the peace process suffering state of clinical death. But definitely for different perspectives, for different reasons, I mean, when we say that. When there is confiscation of land going in very rapid way for the Palestinian territories, when there is more settlements being built vertically, horizontally, adding new settlements, when there is bond standing policy by and ghettoizing policy for the heavy populated areas in the West Bank by the pass by road, which rule out any future opportunity for expansion of the Palestinian areas, heavily populated areas, when there is this connection between the north of the West Bank, south of the West Bank, when there is this connection between East Jerusalem and Jericho, when there is total isolation between Gaza and the West Bank, even the social economical level, in the end of the day, you don't have really any peace process. What you are having de facto apartheid system. And basically, the Oslo Agreement's philosophy, according to those who made it, was very simple. Confidential building measure process. In the end of the day, we don't have neither confidence, nor peace, nor human rights. And to get rid of that and what should be needed, it's quite simple. Palestinian people should have the right of self-determination and independence in Gaza, West Bank, including East Jerusalem.
And in terms of the what you see as the way to break this continued logjam or this clinical death of the peace process, do you envision that unfortunately there may end up being another intifada that the people themselves may have to take into their hands moving this process forward?
First, about the European role, I don't think Mr. Peres means it. He knows that there is veto, by Netanyahu government on the European role. Not only that, but the American administration actually vetoizing any role for the European Union. And all the way along, the European Union has been subjugated to incredible pressure not to have really active role, though they have interests, security interests, political interests, and they are the donors for the entire peace process as far in the region. I think, you know, that's in a way quite cynical and strange, and Palestinian demand was all the way along. I mean, Europe should have very precise role, especially the U.S. government is not acting as sponsor or co-sponsor for the peace process, and it's just leaving, Netanyahu acting in obscenity way vis-a-vis the occupied territories and vis-a-vis the Palestinians. I don't think, according to this highly explosive situation, there will be new intifada. The people tried the intifada for 7 years, peaceful means, stones maximum vis-a-vis the occupation, and they conveyed message, we want the right of self-determination, we want independence. What they got right now, extremely devastating economical situation and apartheid system with incredible Israeli policies made the people feeling, A, there is no peace process and they don't believe in it. 2, there is no faith in the future. 3, they have nothing to lose. I believe there will be no new intifada, but definitely if the volcano erupted and if these angry masses erupted, there will be quite a lot of bloodshed, because Israel, de facto, according to its policies, making call for war.
Finally, Raju Sarani, in this country, people who care about what's going on in the Middle East, what do you think is the most effective role they can play?
knowing about the facts, this is, I mean, our mission, what's going on there, and to which extent really the situation deteriorated. For a free people, we don't instruct, we don't tell. They have to know. Even those who are supporting Israel shouldn't wait till Israel come to path of blood. There is human blood, which is holy in both sides. We shouldn't wait till it split there. I hope that, you know, sort of free, genuine effort being carried to bring peace, and the only way to bring peace to that part of the world by making the Palestinians able to carry on their right of self-determination and independence. They showed their commitment for peace. They came to incredible level of compromise, and they showed their willing to coexist with the Israeli state in neighboring state.
I know you were brought here by the organization Grassroots International, which is based in Boston, which has launched a $1 million campaign for Palestine, a three-year campaign for democracy and development. We only have about 30 seconds, but if you could describe what that's about.
Grassroots International, very serious organization. It's people-to-people work. They're supporting democracy, rule of law, human rights. They're supporting some real serious, genuine Palestinian organizations in different sectors, human rights, agriculture, and health. They are doing good work, and the most importantly, in the role they are doing, it's not funding relation, it's adopting the stand, I mean, of these organization, the stand of the Palestinian civil society, try to make its reflection on the American people as well.
Well, Raju Sarani, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Raju Sarani is the director and founder of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Raju Sarani, the Gaza Strip's foremost human rights lawyer. And if you want to get in touch in this country with Grassroots International, you can call 617-524-1400. That's 617-524-1400. Thanks for being with us, Raji.
Amy, thank you. It's always a pleasure and honor to be with you.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to look at the Philippines. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. 100 years ago today, on June 12, 1898, the leaders of the Philippine Revolution held a constitutional convention and founded the First Republic of the Philippines. The Revolutionary Army had just defeated Spanish colonial forces all over the island, and the United States held only Manila. Immediately after the Constitutional Convention, the U.S. refused to recognize the Republic, and in a proclamation of, quote, benevolent assimilation, the U.S. announced its intention to annex the Philippines. To make it legal, the U.S. paid Spain 20 million silver pesos, or 2 silver pesos, for each Filipino. The leaders of the Philippine Revolution resisted U.S. colonization and fought a war against U.S. forces for 5 years. More than half of the U.S. Army was sent to, quote, pacify the islands. The U.S. banned the Philippine flag and national anthem and imposed martial law. During this war, the Filipino death toll was estimated at 250,000. This weekend, there's going to be a number of events marking the anniversary, including conferences examining the historical ramifications of the U.S. invasion of the Philippines and the popular resistance against imperialism, which continues to this day. Among those sponsoring conferences this weekend is the Gabriela Network, named for the woman warrior who led the longest revolt against Spanish colonial rule. Her name was Gabriela Silang. It's an alliance of more than 100 women's organizations, Gabriela Network, and the largest women's assembly in the Philippine archipelago. We're joined right now by several people from Gabriela. Chris Ho is with us in the studio. She's an organizer with Gabriela Network and currently researching the political economy of women's labor, writing a PhD thesis at the New School for Social Research. And joining us on the telephone, we hope, is Lisa Masa. She is the Secretary General of Gabriela in the Philippines, and she's also a founding member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, why don't we begin with Lisa Masa? It's great to have you. You have just flown in from the Philippines. Can you talk about the significance of this day?
Well, this June 12 is very significant, first of all, because we were able to gain our freedom from the Spanish colonizers, and that is one thing that we should be happy about and should be celebrating. But also, the other side of the history is that the United States colonized us, and that is something that we should continue to fight for, because until now, the United States continue to dominate the economic, social, and political life in the Philippines. And although for 100 years the United States have colonized and recolonized the Philippines, on the other hand, the Filipino people continue to fight against this colonization.
Lisa Masa, many people in this country are not aware of that early history. Of course, the Spanish-American War is one of those wars that is not extensively taught in U.S. schools, but being a Puerto Rican and our island also, Puerto Rico was taken over during the same war, and we had a similar problem that the island had gained autonomy from Spain the year prior to the U.S. invasion. Almost the same thing happened. But could you talk a little bit about that war for independence? Because it was the first war, I think, that actually created an anti-imperialist movement in this country of Americans who were opposed to the continued U.S. occupation of the Philippines.
You know what is unfortunate about our history is that it was the Americans who interpreted the history for us. The Americans were the ones who established the educational system, and they were the ones who interpreted the history. And, of course, they would want to get away with it by teaching that, in the first place, the Americans were there to help us. But on the contrary, during the Filipino-American War, thousands of Filipinos were killed. And historians even say that the Philippines was the first Vietnam. Communities were hamleted during that time. Diseases were common. Many women, children, and men were killed during the Philo-American War. And we know of what happened in Samar. This is in the Visayas island in the Philippines. And this community, a barrio in that area, was totally burned down, killing the women, children, and men during the Philo-American War. So this was a point in our history which the United States and even the current government, the puppet governments that were established under the tutelage of the United States, are trying to hide and have hidden from the Filipinos.
What about how the subjugation of women and colonialism fits together? I mean, something interesting in reading about Filipina history is how many prominent women there were. Chris Ho, maybe you could address this point. In fact, going back to, and it goes before this, of course, the woman whom your network is named after, Gabriela.
Yeah. Gabriela Silang was the woman warrior who led the longest revolt against Spanish colonialism in the 18th century. But even prior to this, before 1898, the Philippine communities were led by women priestesses called Babaylan, who were, you know, revered women leaders. And these were the people who were most violated by the Spanish colonialists with the introduction of Catholicism. So even from before 1898, it was the women who resisted the Spanish and resisted colonialism. And the women have continued this resistance. They've they played a large role in the revolutionary armies. And until this day, they have been a crucial component of the national democratic movement.
And Gabriela Silang, Lisa Massa, can you explain who she was?
Well, Gabriela Silang was the wife of Diego Silang. She is from the Ilocos region in northern Luzon. And both of them fought against the Spanish colonizers. When Diego Silang died, it was Gabriela Silang who took over, and she led the army and fought valiantly against the Spanish colonizers until she died fighting for freedom for the country. And since that time, there were many other Filipinas who fought against the Spanish colonizers until this anti-colonial sentiment was crystallized into the establishment of Katipunan. This is the revolutionary organization fighting against Spanish colonization. And many women, exemplary women, joined the Katipunan. They were called Katipuneras then, and they were doing different functions or roles during the revolution, like being there, fighting or supporting by means of providing health or medical assistance and things like this for the revolutionaries. So the women were there at the forefront of the struggle. And during the American colonization, there were also women who joined the movement against the American colonization and on to the Japanese occupation during the 1940s. And until now, women in the underground, like the organization under the National Democratic Front, Makibaka, continue the revolutionary tradition of the Katipuneras and are fighting and continuing the struggle for national democracy in the Philippines.
You mentioned the Japanese occupation and, of course, again, what Americans hear often about the Philippines is the return of General MacArthur and the war against the Japanese and the liberation of the Philippines by American troops. But could you talk a little bit about that period and how it was that Philippine independence finally came about after the war?
After the Japanese occupation, you mean?
Yes.
Well, of course, when the Japanese army was defeated by the American forces, the United States established the puppet government in the Philippines. So first it was a Commonwealth government and then a puppet Republican state was established under the tutelage of the United States. So actually, even though there was an so-called independence in the Philippines, but the laws, the leaders, the members of the Senate and the members of the Congress were all pro-Americans, you know, and they would not go against the dictates of their U.S. masters. And this has been going on, and this has shaped the political history of the Philippines until now.
Let's talk about now, and that is in the last few weeks you've had an election. Can you explain who your new president is and also what you think are the key issues in the Philippines today? I mean, U.S. bases were forced to leave, but that colonial legacy continues around issues of prostitution, etc., that grew up in a massive way around the U.S. presence there.
Well, the last election was held in May 11, and former Vice President Joseph Estrada won the election by a wide margin. And
he was an actor?
A popular actor during his time. And he won through the slogan, Era for the Poor. This was a slogan that captured the hearts of the Filipino masses. But if we really look at this slogan deeply, it has practically no content. Like, now President Joseph Estrada said that he will continue the policies, the economic policies of former President Ramos. And we think that precisely these economic policies under the scheme of globalization has been the cause of the current economic problems in the Philippines. The policies of liberalization, privatization, and deregulation have brought major hardships and difficulties for the Filipino people, and these are the major issues that the country is facing now. And the newly elected president said that he will not veer away from these policies, and as a matter of fact, he said that he will continue these policies, and he will continue to follow the footsteps of former President Ramos.
I'd like to ask Chris Ho. You are doing your research on the political economy of women's labor in Southeast Asia, and there has been a massive immigration to this country over the last several decades of Filipinos, and there is an explosion, obviously, of investment in Southeast Asia by many European and American companies. Could you talk a little bit about how that has emerged? What are the forces that have created this massive immigration here, as well as the what I call the reverse migration of capital into that region?
Okay, well, Gabriela Network actually works with Filipinas who are in America who are working as they're working in jobs like domestic work. They're here as prostitutes or as, quote, mail order brides. And we see these as a direct result of the policy of the Philippine government, which encourages the export of human labor to other countries. This is the largest export that in the Philippine economy. And the remittances from these overseas contract workers are the largest source of foreign currency now in the country. And so we have a system where economic policies are based on Filipinos leaving their homes and going to work for you know, families in America, going to work in terrible conditions where they're fulfilling what are traditionally, you know, subordinate women's roles, providing domestic and sexual services to people with more money than they. And so we see this as a direct outcome of policies that Lisa was talking about, connected with globalization, connected with liberalization, privatization, deregulation, all these sorts of things we see as continuing the imperialist legacy of U.S. control, which is now manifested in institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
And you also have free trade zones and sweatshops, corporations moving in to replace the U.S. bases.
Right. Actually, in Subic and Clark, the former bases that where the U.S. military was based, we now have what are called special free port zones or special economic zones, where there is the establishment of foreign companies who get all sorts of tax breaks and, you know, they're free from all sorts of environmental and labor laws. So, and they're like the economic zones of which there are several more in the Philippines. And these are zones where women's labor is particularly important.
Well, that is going to have to wrap up our discussion for today. But if people want to find out more information about the Gabriela Network in this country, can you give us a phone number that they can call? We've been speaking with Chris Ho, who is an organizer with Gabriela Network, and Lisa Massa, who's just come in from the Philippines for a major meeting of the Gabriela Network on this 100th anniversary of independence and also U.S. occupation of the Philippines. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! That phone number?
212-592-3507.
That's 212-592-3507. If people would like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Well, Democracy Now! Is produced by Hsu Koo and Jeremy Scahill. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!